Okay, now to the topic at hand, which is another battle, which is the creation-evolution battle, which in many ways is even more important because we can patch these people up, but they're going to die anyway, and you're going to die anyway, and so we have to actually do something for the fact that they can live forever. There's a couple verses from devotion, and if you're taken to take to the book of Acts, excuse me, Romans. Romans chapter 1, I mentioned this yesterday, but not all of you are here, is a great passage, and we're going to talk about it in much, much more depth tomorrow in church. But it's the most definitive passage on the general revelation of God to himself. In Romans chapter 1, the Lord makes it clear that he's made himself known to everybody, even though all of those Iraqi people. It says, starting in verse 16, Paul says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness," or literally who suppress the truth, "because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it unto them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God like unto an image made unto corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed beasts, and creeping things. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves, who changed the truth of God into a lie, and worshipped and served the creation more than the Creator, who's blessed forever." So you have a general revelation where everybody, whether they hear about the Lord Jesus Christ from the Bible or not, everybody can know that there is a God, and they know that from the creation of the world by the things that are made. And the made is really, really important, because that's what's out there. And he says, you know from the creation of the world by the things that are made. And I mentioned last night, the word made, the Greek word made, is used only one other time in the New Testament, and that is the book Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10, where Paul says we are his what? Workmanship. His workmanship created in Christ Jesus. Now that's really important, because what he's saying is, when you look at living things, you don't really catch it as much from the inanimate things, but particularly when you look at living things, the creatures, you see signs of workmanship. Now he's assuming, this is an assumption, that all of us know what workmanship is. If we didn't know what workmanship was, then we wouldn't be able to have any assumption of what it is. But all of us know workmanship. All of us have seen workmanship. And since I'm talking to a bunch of guys, all of us have probably done some kind of workmanship or built something in our lives. And I suspect, looking at the age of most of you, when you're in school, did you take some type of shop class? Everybody took a shop class. So we've all built something, and we've all made something with our hands. And the fact that we make things with our hands, this is just a little parenthetical thought, I think really, really honors the Lord. To do something with these honors the Lord. We've lost sight of that in this day and age. And these things really only get used for a couple of activities, and particularly in younger people these days. They're used for what? This and this. But you don't really see them using this for a whole lot of other stuff on that. In fact, a study came out that it should really shock you guys. And it was on grip strength and arm strength. When I was a kid, the average grip strength of a 20-year-old female was equivalent to the grip strength of what age of the average man? A 75-year-old man. So 20-year-old female had the average grip strength of a 75-year-old man. And men and young men in their early 20s had the highest grip strength between the ages of 20 and 30 of anybody. A study came out last week that says for the average millennial who's 22 years old male, his mother has more grip strength than he does. Do you believe it? His mother has more grip strength than the average American, and it's just American males. So using these really honors the Lord. And how do I know? Because when the Lord became flesh and came to earth, he used what? He used this because he was a carpenter who worked with wood and stone and all those other kinds of things. So he's revealing himself by what he has made. So when we look at living things, we should see workmanship. Now the question is, for men's Bible study today, what if God's workmanship and how it worked was so radically different than human workmanship that we couldn't even figure it out? I mean, you could figure out a computer, we could make train engines, we could do all kinds of stuff, but when you went to study living things, what if it was so different than how humans build things, you couldn't figure it out? Would that provide a good revelation of God to people? The answer would be no. Of course it wouldn't. Because if I looked at a living thing and I couldn't even figure out how it worked, you could say it evolved. I could say it was designed. You could say it was magic. You could say space aliens. How would anybody know? You couldn't know because you can't figure it out. It could be any of those solutions. But if the way living things operate corresponds tightly, in fact, if it corresponds exactly like man-made things work, in other words, if you want locomotion, living things are going to have mechanical properties like man-made things would have locomotion. If you want to break something down and digest it, it's going to be the same way that we would break things down in a chemical reaction. If it's operating by the exact same engineering principles as man-made things, is that a good revelation of the existence of God? Yes, it is. And not only is it a great revelation, it makes it extremely hard to argue evolution, space aliens, magic, but it makes it really easy to argue design. Because you see a one-to-one correspondence. So if you have a system, a man-made system, and systems are made up of elements, you have a part, a part, a part, and a part of a system, right? And not only do you have the parts, but you put the parts in a specific order to get a system, and you end up getting properties which are greater than the system itself. Is that not true? So you take the parts, you drive trains. All of those parts of the engine give you something that's greater than that. Or you can take diodes and transistors and things like that, and you have the elements of each one of those parts, but when you put them together in a specific arrangement, you get a radio. And that's how living things work too. You have a system, you can look for parts, and then you can look for the order of the parts, and they're going to match the same systems that man-made things do. And you get very similar functions. So, this is just a quick introduction. I'm not going to go through this whole poster. It's very, very complicated. But we want to come up with a way to explain adaptation. And so, I've developed a model, and we're going to develop this model tonight, called continuous environmental tracking, which is a design-based, or really an engineering-based. It's an engineering-based perspective on how creatures self-adjust to pre- and post-flood environments. Now, I use the words self-adjust rather than adapt, even though they mean the same things. If you were to look up something that's adaptable, it's something that adjusts, and they usually adjust themselves. I like self-adjust because it does two things. One, it keeps the focus on the creature, on the thing that you've built, and not on the environment. And tonight we're going to get into that in much more detail of why there's this strong emphasis on nature and on the environment today, and why it fits right with Romans chapter 1, where it says they worshiped and served the creation more than the creator. But when I build something, and whenever you build something, you build all of its capabilities into it. And if it's going to adjust, if it's going to be adaptable, you will build its adaptability into the thing. Does that make sense? If you don't build it in, it's not going to do it. And so it's really a self-adjusting thing. Last night I used the illustration of a cruise control on a car. Cruise controls are self-adjusting. They'll stay at the same speed until they hit a hill, going up or going down a hill. But there is a sensor and there is logic, and it's going to adjust itself up and down the hill. Now, I noticed I also said this is pre- and post-fall environments. Now, the typical understanding is that when Adam sinned and the curse came, that the world radically changed. That's not necessarily true. What radically changed was death came into the world. There was a corruption that came into the world. People started to die because of that. But in terms of the trees that we saw, the grass that we would see, the plants that we would see, and how they would adjust, they're probably doing it today exactly like they did on the day that they were created. There wasn't a massive change. And the way you're adjusting today is the way Adam was adjusting. So if we can explain how organisms adjust, it's probably going to explain how they've been adjusting right from the very beginning. Now, evolutionists, we just talk about evolutionists, but these people generally are what we would call naturalists. They begin with nature, nature creating itself through the Big Bang, and then nature creating life, which they claim, but nobody's shown, and then nature leading to the diversity of life. But in their view, the environment is running the show, and organisms are relatively passive. We'll build this a lot more tonight. But as you can see from pictures here, and I could show you these by the dozens, evolution, geology, and climate drive diversification. And in their view, the environment is molding and making and shaping all of life. It's driving life. And creatures are relatively passive. And they see life being driven by climate change. They see life being driven by various geological activities and all kinds of other things like that. However, what if life is not like that? What if we go back to the view that people had of life before Darwin ever came on the scene? What you see there up on the picture is it's a ship. It's just a drawing. But this ship really exists. And it's a totally automated submarine hunting ship. It's about the size of a small destroyer was in World War II. And this is what this article says about this ship. A new vessel, it's actually not quite that new, will patrol the world's oceans, hunting and tracking enemy submarines, and will execute its missions without a single human on board. So this ship is out there and it runs, and it hunts down, hopefully, enemy submarines. Well, how do they do it? For the next level of tracking, the vessel will be armed with state-of-the-art sensors. Bunch of guys, would that ship have to have sensors if it's going to track a submarine? Exactly. Okay. I wouldn't do this with a mixed crowd, but sensors for what? Sensors for what? If you're going to design a sub-hunting ship, what do you want to be able to detect on that submarine? Sound. Okay, sound. Who said sound? That's it. Obviously, sound is a good one. You want to have sound sensors. But what else? Heat. Do you think those subs put off some heat? Of course they do. Everything does. So you have heat sensors. You have sound sensors. What else?
Do you have any kind of metal detector?
You could have metal detectors, metal sensors on that. Do they put off little vapors into the waters, chemicals and stuff like that for things? Yes, they do. So you'd have chemical sensors, metal sensors, sound sensors, some kind of motion sensors. Of course you could have a shape sensor. You want to be able to differentiate it from a whale or things like that. So you're putting on this all kinds of sensors. So that you're thinking, how are they going to try to escape us? Make their subs quieter, right? Make them not put off as much heat. So you're going to make the sensors, and you're going to make them really, really, really sensitive. So they can pick up just the smallest stuff. So that it can detect the quietest enemy submarines. The idea is that it will be nearly impossible for a hostile sub to slip an unmanned vessel on its tail. Okay, but it's an unmanned vessel. So now we're a bunch of engineers and we're going to design this baby. What do you do with the data that you get from your sensors? It has to go to what? Computers. The computers are going to analyze that data. And the computers then are going to say, if you detect this, so let's say we detect everything that is the signature of an enemy submarine. If we detect this, A, B, C, D, and it matches an enemy sub, then do what? Then track it. Then follow it. If it turns, you want to what? Turn. You want to stay on its tail. And if it's hostile, one of your then arguments, since the ship also carries weapons, is going to be what? If this, then attack. Attack. That's how it'll work. And do you think it has GPS? Satellites? Sensor? Yes. It's studded with all of this array of ways to navigate. Do you think creatures have the same things? Yes. They have the exact same things, and they're being used in the exact same way. In fact, a study came out just a few months ago. We already know that lots of birds use the magnetic poles to navigate by. But there's a study came out that humans possibly have that same sense too. And humans can orient towards even poles and things. But we use other stuff to navigate. We can use the sun to navigate. There's butterflies that use the sun to navigate. So these monarchs, which are flying from Canada to Mexico or from Mexico back to Canada, they're using the sun to navigate, but the trouble is the sun is moving all day long as it goes across the sky. So in their antenna, not only do they have a sun tracker, they have a chronometer, a clock, which adjusts their course as the sun is moving across the sky. So you have a sun sensor, but you also have a clock sensor, and it's integrating the data so that you stay on course even though the sun's moving. I mean, it's just really, really incredible what these creatures are able to do. So we have two radically different views of the world. Are organisms passive or organisms active? So, here's the
most revolutionary feature yet. A car that can see trouble and stop itself to avoid it.
Oh, look at that engineer. So, sorry it wasn't that loud, but that was easy. It's a Subaru commercial. Nobody's in the car. They launch the car down the track, and it stops. Did the wall stop it, or did it stop itself? It stopped itself. What do you think it has on the front of the car? Sensors. And then there's logic. And it says, if you sense this, then do this. And the engineer, you saw at the end, he was pretty proud. Should he be? Of course. That's a pretty good design. But that's how we need to start seeing creatures. Radically different. Not as passive modeling clay being driven through space and time by our environment, but rather like this car, like that submarine hunting, as active problem-solving entities that are able to detect changes around them, adjust to those changes, and be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. A radically different way of looking at creatures, because that's what Darwin did. He changed the way we look at them. So since this was a scientific poster that I presented at a scientific conference, you always have to have the question. Question, does the data indicate that the form of organisms is externally imposed upon them over time by fluctuating environmental conditions, or what they call pressures, or does the data indicate that organisms are like drones, who drive themselves through time, continually tracking dynamic environmental changes while making suitable changes to their own form by internal means. That is, I can't emphasize how important that really is. What Darwin did, and we'll talk about this a lot tonight, is he went from this view of creatures, which was the dominant view before Darwin, and he went to this view of creatures, that their form was imposed on them by the environment, that the environment was shaping them and the environment is molding them. So, if this is how it really happens, right here, since I'm talking to a bunch of guys, how does it happen? How do we self-adjust over time? If that's really how, I mean, do we relate to our environment? That's the question. Do you relate to your environment? Of course you do. You're relating to your environment. So the question is, how do you relate to your environment? How do you relate to your environment? Darwin had a very simplistic view. He saw that we related to our environment. Stepping away from the microphone for a second.
So he could see. Here's a creature. It's in this condition. The condition changes maybe from wet to dry. And after it goes to dry condition, now creatures are expressing traits that are suitable for dry conditions. So therefore, he said, the drought caused these conditions. Because he could see a drought, and he could see the new conditions, and he said, therefore, the drought causes it. The drought drives it. The drought does it. He could get away with that, because in his day, nobody could see inside the creatures. And I don't mean parts and muscles. I mean at the cellular level. Nobody could see what was happening in the cells. Nobody knew about DNA. Nobody understood any of that. So droughts causing this was understandable. And that is how biology is operating today by everybody. The trouble is that's so dated, because now we can see what's happening in the cells. We have a whole new world open to us, which is the exact opposite. That at the cellular level, all the way to the organism level, what's really happening is organisms are actually adjusting themselves by the same mechanism that a man-made tracking system would do it. And there's four elements to a tracking system, and that submarine hunter has these exact four elements. They have sensors. They have condition consequence logic. Logic says, if you sense this condition, then do this. They have output responses, and if you want to track something over time, and definitely if you want to intercept, you have to have some kind of clock. You have to have a chronometer on board. And creatures use these chronometers a lot. So if you have a mama sea turtle and she lays her eggs on an island that is 3 miles across, and she makes her way all the way across the Atlantic Ocean down by the Caribbean, and then she wants to go back and lay her eggs on the exact same island on the same time, she needs to navigate across the Atlantic Ocean to hit an island that's 3 miles across. And she's going to do that by using celestial and polar navigation with a clock that she lands on the same island 3 miles across. That's a navigational feat to do it. And so we have to build a model. How is this happening? Well, organisms relate to their environment because they have built-in capabilities enabling them to relate to their environment. And if they didn't have those capabilities built in, they would not relate to their environment, period. So it's not the environment. It's not the drought causing changed conditions. You detect the drought and you express changed conditions. You do it through the exact same mechanisms that any man-made thing would do. You have sensors for your external conditions. You have logic. You have output responses. The same way that you have sun tracking devices that have sensors to detect where the sun is. Logic to follow it in little motors that can move it to follow those areas. And organisms have these exact same elements in them, starting at even the cellular level. So what you see here
This is a cell membrane. And all those little colored squiggly things are sensors. Tens of thousands of sensors on a single cell. On a single cell. And of course, you notice that the environment in their view, they have those little thunderbolts there because their view, the environment's running everything. Environmental conditions are either there or they're not. It's the cell which detects them, and the cell begins to process the data long before it ever gets to the nucleus of the cell. It's processing the data en route, and then the cell is going to respond. But not only do you have those same sensors on your cells, you have sensors on your organs. You have entire organ systems, and your body, your entire body is covered with those same kinds of sensors. We know the big ones, eyes and ears and things like that, but you have sensors for pressure. You have sensors for temperature, sensors for all kinds of things, particularly pain. So you have sensors by the thousands all over you, and they're constantly, constantly integrating data. And the data comes from a stream which at basal level is at millions of signals per second. Millions of signals per second. And then it adjusts those up or down as you detect more of it or less of it. And it's all being integrated in your brain. Isn't this quite fascinating of how organisms are doing these things? So I had a whole bunch of examples of how organisms are going to track changes over different generations, how there was a target in the environment and they had a sensor specific for that target, how they had a specified self-adjustment, and then a few principles of design. I just want to go through a couple of these just to kind of whet your appetite for some of the stuff we'll talk about tonight. Here's an interesting one. It says, talks about bacteria in your gut activate host satiety. What in the world does that mean? Well, the better thing is to do, let's just look at this picture right here. This is really, the picture says it all. The picture looks kind of complicated, but it's really kind of cool. Turn around so I can point to the picture. These are cells in your gut. The cells in your gut have lots of little finger-like projections because you have a lot of surface area to absorb the things that you just ate on breakfast right now. Inside your gut are all different kinds of bacteria. So when you ate breakfast today, the number of bacteria went from this level, and then suddenly they rapidly start to multiply. So right now, the bugs in your gut are increasing in number because you just put a bunch of food in it, and it's going to go there. And these bugs, when I'm talking about bugs, I'm talking about bacteria, are going to help you digest the food. But they also do something else, which is kind of cool. When those bugs increase in number, they detect what is in the food. And some of them produce a protein which these cells absorb and they put directly into your bloodstream. This is a blood vessel. And some of them produce proteins which are absorbed by the cells of your gut. And when they absorb that, they produce another protein and put it in your bloodstream, and they do another one. So you see three different types of products that are produced and put into your bloodstream, which are a result of the cells of your gut, but they're able to detect proteins that the bacteria make when the bacteria detect the food in your gut. So food comes in, goes into your gut, the bacteria detect the food in your gut, they increase in number, they start producing products, some of which the cells directly absorb and put into your bloodstream, some of which are modified by the cells and put into your bloodstream, but when those are put into your bloodstream, they travel all the way back to your brain, and when they get to your brain, they give you the sense that you're full, and so that you stop eating. That's pretty cool. That's really, really cool because not only is it you doing something, it's you working really closely with what? The bacteria. It's like they were made to work like a hand in a glove together. And every one of it, this is a good picture because it shows that the bacteria are sensing the food. Then your gut detects the products of the bacteria. Then they put it into the bloodstream, and then your brain detects those products. So you have a completely closed-loop system of how those things are working together. If two autonomous entities are going to work together, they have to have an interface. Here's an interesting one. This is of some flies that can detect humidity. They have a humidity sensor in their antenna, and they can detect the humidity. And this is what's really cool about this, is they live in specific places with specific humidity. And the humidity sensor that they have is essentially the size of a single neuron. And it detects hot, cold, and other kinds of things and integrates that all together, and it comes up with what the relative humidity is outside. The smallest human sensor like that fits on a quarter. That's the smallest one that humans have been able to make, and theirs is on the tip of their antenna the size of a single neuron on how they're able to do that. And they integrate that data and move around from place to place on there. This is an interesting one. How do birds migrate from salty environments to less salty environments? So they're able to detect the concentration of salt, sodium, in their bloodstream because they have a salt sensor down next to their heart, which is able to detect the salt in their bloodstream. So here's a picture of a gull. When you think of gulls, you think of creatures living down on the by the ocean. Are there seagulls in Rapid City? There are. I go to Texas and I ask them that, and they think, no way, there's no seagulls in Rapid City, because those people are geographically stunted. Well, just put it that way. They have a hard time finding Oklahoma. But anyway, so they're a little geographically stunted. But anybody who lives there, there's seagulls in Rapid City. There may even be seagulls in Gillette. You see seagulls everywhere, and they seem to live through the winter and everything here just fine. So you have seagulls. But let's say the seagull came to its senses down in Houston and wants to migrate to Rapid on there. They're going to change. Or if a seagull wants to go visit its cousin from Rapid and migrate down to Houston, they're going to change. What are they going to do? The gulls down there start drinking water that's in the ocean, which is full of salt. And the salt would normally be lethal to these birds. But it isn't. Because once they detect an increase in salt concentration in their bloodstream, a gland, which is not here in the gulls living in Gillette or Rapid City, a gland right up by here by their eye is going to form de novo, meaning it's not there, but it will form. You'll form an entire gland from scratch. And the gland is going to look an awful lot like a kidney. It's going to function and work like a kidney, and that gland is going to filter out the sodium in their bloodstream, and it's going to excrete it out through a little duct up there by their beak. So when they fly down to Houston, this gland will form de novo, and when they come to their senses and fly back to Rapid, the gland will go away. That's quite remarkable. And how are these organisms doing it? They're doing it by the fact that they can track all different things around their environment, and they're doing it with a one-to-one correspondence through sensors, logic mechanisms, and output devices. And I could go through dozens more examples. And tonight, we will go through more examples illustrating just exactly how creatures do this. However, the witness is that this is evidence of workmanship. It has multiple parts working together for a purpose which are completely analogous to human-designed things with the same types of elements in the same arrangement and functioning in the same way. But the main take-home message, we're going to end here, 1 minute, is the difference in the way we see creatures. If creatures relate to their environment, it's because they have what? They have the innate ability to relate to their environment. And if they adjust, it's because they adjust themselves. They're not passive modeling clay. They're active problem-solving creatures, which the Lord has made to really glorify himself. We'll elaborate more on that tonight, Lord willing. But since we've reached our time limit, I'll turn it back to Pastor. Thank you very much.